Lucky Land Slots, you can get lucky just about anywhere.
Dearly beloved, we are gathered here today to... Has anyone seen the bride and groom?
Sorry, sorry, we're here. We were getting lucky in the limo and we lost track of time.
No, Lucky Land Casino, with cash prizes that add up quicker than a guest registry.
In that case, I pronounce you lucky.
Play for free at LuckyLandSlots.com. Daily bonuses are waiting. No purchase necessary. Void where prohibited by law. 18 plus. Terms and conditions apply. See website for details.
Hey guys, it is Ryan. I'm not sure if you know this about me, but I'm a bit of a fun fanatic when I can. I like to work, but I like fun too. It's a thing. And now the truth is out there. I can tell you about my favorite place to have fun. Chumba Casino. They have hundreds of social casino style games to choose from with new games released each week. You can play for free anytime, anywhere. And each day brings a new chance to collect daily bonuses. So join me in the fun. Sign up now at ChumbaCasino.com.
No purchase necessary. VGW. Void where prohibited by law. See terms and conditions. 18 plus.
Hello, everybody. Welcome to today's show. My name is Spencer Walsh. We've got a good one for you here. As always, we are talking elections today. We're going through it all. And the Democrats, folks, they are not feeling good. They're feeling battered. They're feeling hopeless. And we'll take a look at the implications on that. Meanwhile, the Democrats in Congress are also feeling pretty battered at the moment. They tried to, frankly, just raise any sort of doubt about our policy towards Ukraine and just the, policy of just sending money there, sending weapons there, and just pretty much dropping them off, turning the other way, and hoping for the best. Meanwhile, Larry Krasner is under attack in Pennsylvania. Lawmakers there in the state Senate that was about to overturn the election if it hadn't been for our judicial system holding on by a thread. They are now trying to impeach the Democratically elected DA of Philadelphia for being, not a psychopath or whatever, just like they are, but they are relying on a flawed study to blame prosecutorial policies for increased murders. So that's what they're going for. We'll take a look at that effort and the possibility of its success. Big day, a lot of key stories. Great episode to tune into. It's Newsflash. All right, so it is midterm time. Things are setting in, and it is getting to be, I think relatively serious. It's getting to be to a point where, you want to start, I think it's literally, 2 weeks away. This really just wants to start, people, 99% of the public, frankly, starts to pay attention to matters of importance around elections. And so reality is setting in. This is the mindset now for the Democrats. They're now on the defense, and blue states are now bracing for a red wave in the House. The Senate is a different story, but they pretty much now are saying the House is gone for good. Some of the more Democratic people all but admitting defeat. We talked about this on the last show. You had this case of rash of just really self-interested people who were frankly not trying to do the best for the party and really didn't care about advancing a broader political project, just plop their own Democrats into random races and were just like, we're going to put them in there because we don't want the wrong Democrat, aka in most cases the left, more left wing, actually connected to the community with most likely a better chance to win. That candidate was cast aside because, they don't have the fundraising advantage. Well, guess what happens to the fundraising advantage the moment the individual person decides they don't want any part of the campaign anymore, and they're not in it for the long haul. And, these people, they're going to lose, and they're not going to gain anything from it. So this story here in the New York Times, as we are seeing, kind of the shifting winds, we had abortion, we had the student loan thing, we had gas prices going down. Things are starting to look pretty optimistic for the Democrats there. They're putting together some, a string of last minute plays. Also the weed thing was, I think also another thing to kind of, keep that poll pull rise afloat. I mean, gas prices haven't really gone back up that much, but you know, there's also the sense of the vibe, you know, inflation, just general energy prices, nothing really to be done about them, out of Biden's control. And also, I think some local messages on crime have been very, very effective because, again, these are effective Republican messages. There's no one denying that. But if there was an actual political apparatus to the Democratic Party, if they were actually, you know, a party that was fit for purpose, this would be something that they would be able to counter against and put up a coordinated message against. And they're just not coordinated as a party or as a movement at all, and never have been when in comparison to the Republicans. I would be interested to see what's going on, here in Rhode Island, see what the specific issue is that's dominating this campaign. But here in Providence, this is Providence, Rhode Island may be Republican. Republicans are pressing their advantage deep into Democratic territory in the closing stretch of the 2022 campaign, competing for abundance of House seats amid growing signs that voters are poised to punish President Biden's party, even in the bluest parts of America. The Democrats have 8 seats, 220 to 212 majority right now. But with 2 weeks until the election, Republicans are looking to run up the score and win a more expansive and governable majority by vying for districts in Democratic bastions, including Rhode Island, which has not sat a Republican Congress for nearly 3 decades. We thought for a little bit we could defy gravity, but the reality is setting in, said Sean McElwain, the director of Data for Progress, which is essentially the kind of outreach movement for, you know, the main organs of the Democratic Party to the, you know, the party's left, essentially. With the Democrats on the defensive in so many places, McElwain said the goal should now be to limit the party's losses so it can conceivably take back the House in 2024. Simply making incursions so deep in the Democratic terrain is a victory for Republicans. Win or lose, they've diverted limited Democratic resources, but Republicans need just 5 seats to net to flip the chamber. And with the current dawning map, some Democratic strategists worry the party could lose far more, even 20 to 30. So in Oregon, Republicans are in contention to win half of the state's soon-to-be 6 congressional seats, up from the 1 seat they currently hold in, you know, it's Oregon. It's going to be pretty Democratic place. In New York, Republicans are pursuing 5 more districts carried by Biden, including one held by Representative Sean Patrick Maloney, the chairman of the DCCC. And I got to say, if they win that, like, this, that is some, like, the people in that district, it happens to be the district where I, like, grew up, like, they do not consider themselves. If you go through most of the people in that district, I definitely live in the more, you know, obviously, Democratic parts of it, but it goes a lot more north. You do get more Republican people in there. It's a lot more north than it used to be. Obviously, the further north you go in New York, the more likely it is to be Republican. But the thing is, they do not consider themselves Republican. Like, you know, you just assume if you live around there that, oh, this is going to be a Democratic district. This is going to be a Democratic district. So when you hear talk about that, and especially in areas that you know, I mean, I don't know. If you are, like, kind of living in one of these areas, if you're living in kind of, you know, the outskirts of Oregon, or you're living in out, like, suburban Providence, you know, these key places in Rhode Island are just really, frankly, you know, the entire state of Rhode Island, because it's, you know, just, no, actually it is two districts there. If you're living in, like, Pawtucket or, you know, Cranston or something like that, what, like, can you or your community members just, like, imagine yourself voting for a Republican if you haven't done so in, like, 3 decades? I think New York gets a little bit less long than that for some of the people in that area, but it's really going to be a big jump for a lot of people to switch parties. And the question is Biden's America that bad? And that is something that, like, when you talk about the polls, and when you look at how bad things have been for Biden, and to really to make that step, you know, it just does not seem to be such a big deal. But of course, that can all change, even in Democratic areas. If the quote-unquote blue people, which are, you know, the red people and the blue people, the bases, if you will, are becoming smaller and smaller every year as more and more people check out of politics, that they see can do nothing for them. So the question with the blue states is, how deeply Republicans can go into the map or how narrow a majority they might end up with, says Jesse Ferguson, a Democratic strategist who has worked on House races. So pretty much saying, you know, how bad is it going to be? Damage control. The flow of the money from super PACs and national party committees, which prioritize mostly competitive races, reveals a House battleground landscape that is overwhelmingly tilted towards seats Biden won in 2020. Such a landscape is significant. Saying Democrats have all but given up contesting more Republican terrain. Just saying, you know, they are on the back burner. So let's go to Rhode Island. Biden carried the seat by nearly 14 percentage points less than 2 years ago, but it now could deliver the first House Republicans their first House seat in the state this millennium. If Democrats are playing defense in Rhode Island, they're losing across the country since Stephen Frias, who has served on the Republican National Committee in Rhode Island for the last decade. They moderated Alan Fung, a former mayor of Cranston, who ran previously for governor and had campaigned to be a voice of moderation in Congress. And he said fear of the economy had been the dominant issue of the campaign. And they're sending Jill Biden now, the first lady, down to Providence to try and build support for this guy, Seth Magaziner, who's running in the Democratic state treasurer. They're sending his wife and not the president himself because they know how wildly unpopular he is. He's underwater here. He's underwater across the country, says Alan Fung. And yeah, you can always tell by where they're sending, you know, certain people to certain areas. And that tells you on both sides of the campaign where they think they stand on in these various areas. So, wow. You know, October, this past October, this current October, as we are almost done with the month, finally. Harris went to Connecticut and appeared with vulnerable Democratic incumbent. Please send her back. Harris urged voters at an event for abortion rights. I'm gonna guess that's Johanna Hayes in the northwestern part of Connecticut. Another part where I have family members there. He also made, that is a place that feels like more culturally Republican, especially in this kind of moment, and especially if certain parts of the, you know, and a lot of the Democratic parts of that district, that northern Connecticut district, they're higher, you know, minority populations, people less likely to be excited by, you know, Biden and what Biden's doing for the country, more likely to stay home. And it's just that simple. Biden even had to go to New York, where Governor Kathy Hochul has been leading by far less than Democrats have won in recent years, according to a recent poll, now down to single digits, which is just pretty insane. Biden traveled to Pennsylvania, but notably, his major event on abortion rights last week was held in Washington, D.C., not a battleground seat or district at all. Strategists and officials in both parties said they were seeing the trend of Democratic weakness and Republican overperformance in states that are fully ruled by Democrats. Some have speculated that voters who polls show are generally unhappy by the direction of the country have no one but to blame but Democrats in those states. Others have hypothesized that abortion, the issue that Democrats have used to mobilize their party base and win over moderate women, is less salient in states that have enacted their own abortion protections. And frankly, it's like pretty simple here. They absolutely failed to deliver a
With Lucky Land Slots, you can get lucky just about anywhere.
Dearly beloved, we are gathered here today to... Has anyone seen the bride and groom?
Sorry, we're here. We were getting lucky in the limo and we lost track of time.
No, Lucky Land Casino, with cash prizes that add up quicker than a guest registry.
In that case, I pronounce you lucky.
Play for free at LuckyLandSlots.com. Daily bonuses are waiting. No purchase necessary. Void where prohibited by law. 18 plus. Terms and conditions apply. See website for details. With Lucky Land Slots, you can get lucky just about anywhere.
This is your captain speaking. We've got clear runway and the weather's fine, but we're just going to circle up here a while and get lucky. No, nothing like that. It's just these cash prizes add up quick. So I suggest you sit back, keep your tray table upright, and start getting lucky.
Play for free at LuckyLandSlots.com. Are you feeling lucky? No purchase necessary. Void where prohibited by law. 18 plus terms and conditions apply. See website for details.
Cohesive message, because that's, you know, they only win elections again when there's a more threatening side in the Republican Party, where Donald Trump has to be, you know, in power or, you know, even explicitly on the ballot for them to win. And, you know, really kind of deep memories of just how bad and how unpleasant life under Republican leadership has been. And that, you know, that's the only way you can win as a party that just fundamentally does not offer anything new or different to absolutely anyone. And if you're going to ignore the situation that has been going on with the economy, with putting food on the table, with inflation versus wages and all that stuff, I mean, not even really, you know, take one particular side, just not going to do anything on it. You're not going to come out with a policy, unpopular policy. You're just going to say, guys, we're not in a recession. Don't even worry about it. But have you heard about abortion? You know, that is just not going to fly. It may fly in some specific areas. It may fly in, you know, that one area in New York right after abortion happened, upstate New York. But it is not going to fly nationally. That is just ridiculous, and it is not indicative. It's just not indicative of a party that is serious about winning or can win long-term or serious any kind of political movement because, you know, what are they going to do? Are they going to have to, like, you know, repeal gay rights 1 week before the midterm for them to win? Like, is that, you know, this literally seems to be what it is going to, you know, really take. So in Oregon, the Super PAC line with Nancy Pelosi has yet to spend on behalf of one Democrat, Jamie McLeod Skinner, which, again, I absolutely love this because this shows you who Nancy Pelosi and these people really are. They're willing to throw the House majority away. Nancy Pelosi can go literally, you know, incubate for another 20 years with her equally, like, fossil-like husband in San Francisco, give up her House seat. She doesn't care. But in the meantime, she knows what her real job is, to stop any kind of left-wing people from getting into Congress at all costs, even if it is literally a seat that Biden carried by 9 percentage points and she's running behind because she has no money and has been absolutely abandoned by the party. In California, the same super PAC on Friday that canceled $2.2 million in television reservations had been earmarked to try and unseat Mike Garcia, a Republican. A person involved in this decision described the seat as increasingly out of reach for Democrats, even though Biden carried it by more than 12 points. That is pretty crazy. Mike Garcia is the representative. He is in the, where is he, in the 25th District of California. That is, because I'm, you know, if it's interesting to see what kind of districts they're, you know, worried about. It is one that is mostly Lancaster, California, kind of north of Los Angeles, and, you know, that, I don't know really, frankly, at all very much about, you know, the profile of that district, but, you know, if you look at it, it's, let's see if we can get a little something up here. It is a 491,000 potential voters, 44% white, high Latino population, 10% black, 9% Asian. Immigrants make up, you know, 17% of the voters. So it's, you know, frankly, it is in this 25th congressional district, currently Republican. Biden apparently won this. It should be a D3 Cook political. Biden apparently won this by, I think, 14 points. Oh, and this is the one that, yeah, this is the one that a Democrat just lost, you know, I think, earlier in Biden's administration, but it has just been so out of control because there's nothing the Democrats can do to counter on this at all. And they're just, again, we're seeing this when they put any kind of pressure and when the Republicans aren't completely falling apart, they are fundamentally incapable of doing anything substantive for the long term.
My name is Spencer Walsh. This is the Spencer Walsh Radio Network. And if you're listening to one of our podcasts, whether it's Newsflash, Hidden History, The Spencer Walsh Show, or something else, ladies and gentlemen, we have one simple request of you. Please be sure to rate us, subscribe to us if you like us, and leave us a comment, because just like all of you, sometimes we need that feedback in our lives, good or bad. We want to hear what you have to say. So please do those steps. Make SWR and content better. And thank you so much for listening.
All right, so we are getting back into it today, and we are talking about the House Progressives. And they, you know, and Pramila Jayapal, who I have to say, And, you know, I hate to say it because she could have been in a really cool position in the Biden administration. She could have been, I think, someone who is really up to and, you know, serving as she had the possibility with, you know, enough like 30 hardcore progressive legislators in that House. I would say she had enough kind of clout to do a lot of things. But what she ended up doing instead was really kind of humiliating, just disappointing to see. And she really got outmaneuvered every turn from people like Joe Manchin to Joe Biden on every, you know, infrastructure, reconciliation, all the fights. Pretty much the last, you know, the entire Biden administration content, you know, I'd say that we've done here. You know, it hasn't been, you know, a lot, I know, but, you know, relative to what we would normally do, especially throughout the, you know, the Trump years in terms of our scheduling. But if you look at a lot of the shows, most of them are going to have, I feel like, you know, two-thirds are going to have some sort of story about the progressive caucus failing to kind of stand up to Joe Biden in some kind of way. There's just so many examples of just kind of almost repeatedly, it felt like, throughout the negotiations over the budget or the Build Back Better, like, they were just absolutely, they were from being just ignored and laughed out of the room, or, you know, just not even being a part of the conversation in the first place, not even invited to have a seat at the table because their vote was just taken for granted every single time. Pramila Jayapal would just, you know, compliment the president and just fall in line right behind him. And that's pretty much what we came to see and expect from Jayapal. And with that, you know, that something kind of out of the ordinary for Jayapal kind of caught my eye yesterday, which was really, really kind of interesting. Something that we've, you know, where we've been at Ukraine, you may not have seen too much about it in recent news. I think a lot of that is because we've reached kind of a stalemate setting. We're seeing pretty much the policy is, you know, approve more weapons, send them over, send some more funds over, help, pretty much give Zelensky, you know, whatever he asked for, short of anything that could really directly hit Russia, because we're not that insane. I think that's really the difference between, like, the Republican and Democrat policy on that. You know, to be fair, it depends what kind of Republicans get into power, but the establishment Republican policy is just give them whatever they want. The establishment Democrat policy is just give them enough so they can continue the war indefinitely, and you know, not give them everything so that they can, like, hit Russia and escalate further and stuff like that. But either way, we are not going to try and hold them accountable. We're not going to try and find out what they're doing with these weapons. We're not going to try and track it or trace it in any kind of way or worry about the consequences. All we could do is just send more and more money to Ukraine. And that essentially has been the policy. But it was really, really surprising to see the progressive caucus, which throughout the entire Biden administration has been so incredibly weak, has pretty much gone really quite crazy. On Monday morning, 30 members of the Congressional Progressive Caucus sent a letter to the White House that attempted to gingerly open a conversation about a potential diplomatic end to Russia's war in Ukraine. The door by evening was slammed shut, met with enough fury to elicit a, quote, clarification in the form of a statement from Caucus Chair Pramila Jayapal. This is Ryan Grimm in The Intercept. She wrote, "Let me be clear. We are united as Democrats in our unequivocal commitment to supporting Ukraine in the fight for their democracy and freedom in the face of illegal and outrageous Russian invasion, and nothing in the letter advocates for change in that support." But on Tuesday, Jayapal followed the clarification by fully withdrawing the letter, saying it was released by staff without vetting. So she released, not only did she release that statement, so it's pretty much, they're putting her through humiliation after humiliation. So that letter comes out. I don't know who actually released it, but I'm going to go ahead, given that Pramila Jayapal released the evening statement on the day of, saying that, you know, we support Ukraine's standing up for democracy. We just wanted to clarify that and put that out there and make that extra clear. Apparently that wasn't enough for their statement, so they had to come up and make, you know, what I perceive to be a pretty likely BS story about how, oh, staff leaked it, you know. It is really incredible to be a fly on the wall in some of these conversations. Would have been very interesting. On Monday morning, Washington Post reported that CPC members were urging Joe Biden to dramatically shift his strategy on the Ukraine war and pursue direct negotiations with Russia. The first time prominent members of his own party pushed him to change his approach to Ukraine. The diplomacy, and again, the original letter had this signed signatures of 30 members of the Progressive Caucus. And that letter, that kind of a letter, was released with, supposedly without the consent of the 30 members of Congress. So I find that, you know, relatively hard to believe. So such diplomacy could ultimately end with Russia gaining territory by force, even as it is faltering on the battlefield. That letter was met with fierce opposition as a measure of the space. That the letter was met with fierce opposition as a measure of the space available for debate among congressional Democrats when it comes to support for the war and how it might be stopped before it turns nuclear. So, roughly zero. So, there is no space for any kind of debate like that. I voted for every package to Ukraine and stand firmly for Ukraine's sovereignty, so wrote Khanna of California, letter signer. It should not be controversial to say that we need to explore every diplomatic avenue to seek a peace, a just peace, and end to the war, including engagement of our allies to help with that. Obviously, you know, he's right there. You know, it should not be controversial to say that we should focus on ending this war. But, you know, you can say also, by the way, Rogue Khanna can say that. But there is, I think, a really big thing is, you know, how actually you're going to do it. How are you going to be able to, like, really stand there and stand like say confidently that, you know, we are really working hard to end this war. But what are you doing? I don't see it. You know, the CPC letter took every pain to account for the argument against the U.S. negotiations with Russia over the war. The most common being that obviously Ukraine is the one at war. Therefore, only Ukraine can open the door to diplomacy. Well, you know, that I think is really fundamentally flawed because we are propping up the Ukrainian army at the moment. They would not exist without us, and they really give us very little in the way of oversight. We agree with the administration's perspective that it is not America's place to pressure Ukraine's government regarding sovereign decisions, and with the principle that you've enunciated that there should be nothing about Ukraine without Ukraine, the letter said. We are under no illusions regarding the difficulties of engaging Russia given its outrageous and illegal invasion of Ukraine and its decision to make additional illegal annexations of Ukrainian territory. However, if there is a way to end the war while preserving a free and an independent Ukraine, it is America's responsibility to pursue every diplomatic avenue to support such a solution, and is the that is acceptable to the people of Ukraine. So, so it added that any ultimate framework would need to be approved by, again, yeah, all people, particularly Ukrainians. Late on Monday, Mark Takano also issued a clarifying statement. I think he's also a signee of the letter. The notion that Ukraine is fully guiding the policy is undermined by NATO's intervention against peace talks last spring. Again, I think the idea that that is happening is just, again, not backed up by reality. And the idea that only Ukraine has an interest in the war ignores not just the fact that U.S. funding for it and the obvious point of global nuclear war or any global war is not just a concern for Russia or the United States, but really, frankly, for everybody involved. But at the risk of, as nuclear war increases, fighting in Ukraine escalates and global economies, global economic security deepens, members of Congress urged Biden to pursue direct diplomacy for negotiated settlement to end the war. That was a press release. But the constraints of the debate have made discussing what it could take to stop such consequences and awful things like that off limits. So diplomacy is an important tool that can save lives, but it's just one tool. Jaipal's clarification read. So, yes, this is the tail between the legs statement. As we have also explicitly made clear in a letter, we will support Biden's commitment to nothing about Ukraine without Ukraine. So Chris Murphy, big senator, it was going to be interesting to see what he had to say about it. He was among those to criticize the letter, obliquely writing on Twitter, "There is moral and strategic peril in sitting down with Putin too early. It risks legitimizing his crimes and handing over parts of Ukraine to Russia, an agreement that Putin won't even honor." The letter also ran into an electoral buzzsaw. House Speaker in waiting, Kevin McCarthy, recently told Punchbowl News that Republicans in charge, Ukraine policy could change. I think there are people who are going to be sitting in recession that and saying that they're not going to write a blank check to Ukraine. Democrats have pounded McCarthy for that suggestion. Others came at it directly. So again, actually, there does seem to be a pretty surprising amount of a kind of Democratic or Republican versus Democratic polarization on this when it comes to Ukraine. But I would love to see actually Kevin McCarthy hold up and follow through on that when he gets in office. I kind of doubt it, but you know, I think he's going to be sending Ukraine money just like the rest of them. But Daily Kos founder Marcus Melitzis, the Nancy Pelosi simp, deployed a rhetorical device increasingly used to build guardrails down around debate, which is just really just manipulation, kind of like whataboutism and stuff like that. So if you're not fully supportive of the party position, then you're effectively aligning with Marjorie Taylor Greene, and you're cuckoo, crazy, and insane. So it's like, this is Nancy Pelosi's enforcer. You know, he has very little credibility, but he's out there doing it anyway. So he said, these 30 House progressives are now making common cause with Lauren Boebert, MTG, J.D. Vance, and the rest of the MAGA crowd. You'd think that would give them some pause, Melitzis wrote on Twitter. Which Ukrainians do these progressives want abandoned to mass murder and rape in their attempt to prop up a flailing Russia? The only way to end this war is to help deliver a decisive Ukrainian victory. Eric Sperling, director of Just War and Policy, which endorsed the letter, cast extreme opposition to it as a sign of the fragility of the anti-diplomacy consensus. The shrill response to the utterly moderate letter exposes war. Proponents are scared of an open debate about the range of potential approaches to address this escalating conflict, Sperling says. As happened with the war in Iraq and many others throughout human history, war proponents attempt to silence debate in large part because they aren't confident that their arguments, and are afraid that their pro-diplomacy views will appeal to average Americans, with polls already showing growing opposition. But anyway, what I think this like really, really shows here is just like the absolute foreclosing on debate, and the fact that when it comes down to it, we do not have the politicians currently in elected office who are, you know, backed by a, you know, significantly strong enough popular movement, or just have their own, you know, because politicians don't do anything unless they have like a real incentive to, no matter who they are, I think, to a certain extent. You know, maybe not all of them, but, you know, to be a politician, especially in, like, kind of an elected democracy, at least, you got to have a coalition behind you that is kind of pulling your strings in a certain sense. And this can happen with left-wing politicians, too. But the thing with left-wing politicians is it's better because the movements that are, you know, good left-wing politicians, i.e. Shamus Wandt in Seattle, you know, they have populist left-wing democratically controlled and organized movements behind them, and that is what makes them successful and a powerful, you know, political force to be reckoned with for good, that is going to be actually strong against this stuff instead of just completely melt to all pressure. You know, it's really ridiculous. So, you know, they got hits from this from Marcus Melitzis, and this is like really unbelievable here from Marcus Melitzis. This is the Pelosi stamp here. What he had to say was, again, this is unbelievably naive and stupid. Biden, again, has repeatedly said that only negotiations can ultimately end the conflict, as the letter noted, and that nuclear war is imminent, more imminent now than at any time since the Cuban Missile Crisis, saying, we urge you to pair the military and economic support for the United States with a proactive diplomatic push, redoubling efforts to seek a realistic framework for a ceasefire. The letter offered, this is consistent with your recognition that there's going to have to be a negotiated settlement here. It's a quote from him, and your concern is Biden, and your concern that Vladimir Putin doesn't have a way out right now, and I'm trying to figure out what we do about that. Among congressional Democrats, however, the process of figuring that out is apparently not allowed to include discussion of how to get a negotiated settlement. So, yeah, and then this, just about a few hours ago, actually, we had a really full and embarrassing capitulation from Pramila Jayapal and Mark Pocan. So here's the full, you know, really just prostrating themselves before the White House and, frankly, the establishment at large. The statement reads, the Congressional Progressive Caucus hereby withdraws its recent letter to the White House regarding Ukraine. The letter was drafted several months ago, but unfortunately was released by staff without vetting. As chair of the caucus, I accept responsibility for this. Because of the timing, our message is being conflated by some as being equivalent to the recent statement by Republican leader Kevin McCarthy threatening an end to aid for Ukraine if Republicans take over. The proximity of the statements created the unfortunate appearance that Democrats, who have strongly and unanimously supported and voted for every package of military, strategic, and economic assistance to Ukraine, are, you know, being soft. That something would never, ever pull the plug. But we will never, ever pull the plug on American support for President Zelensky and Ukrainian forces. Every war ends with diplomacy, and this one, too, will end after Ukrainian victory. Again, how? What are you doing to even ensure that? Like, there is no real way. Unless, I mean, are you going to go into Russia? Are you going to start, you know, are we going to start sending them, you know, long surface air range missiles that can go deep into the country? Are we going to, you know, push their, how far are we going to push here? And how far and how long are people who know this stuff is wrong, like Pramila Jayapal, going to stand by and allow it to happen just completely willy-nilly and just completely uninterrupted, like everything's fine? Like, this is going to be a problem here at some point, and people just cannot realize it or even begin to comprehend it. Yeah, so the letter sent yesterday, although restating that basic principle, has been conflated with GOP opposition to support for Ukrainians' just defense of their national sovereignty. As such, it is a distraction at this time, and we will withdraw this letter. This is absolutely just pathetic and embarrassing by all accounts. Anyway, let's move to our last story here, where lawmakers in Pennsylvania, it's again in the Intercept, Akilah Lacey on this, seeking to impeach Philadelphia District Attorney Larry Krasner, released a new report on Monday, whose findings rely partially on a widely criticized study by former Republican District Attorney. The interim report, which reads as a bill of particulars against Krasner, was handed down with a widely expected official recommendation to impeach the progressive district attorney. This is someone who is, you know, a hired gun, former Republican DA, who's pretty much in to kick out the current Philadelphia DA, Larry Krasner. This is the effort that they're trying to do. This is the kind of Philadelphia's version to George Gascon and Chase Boudin. He's actually just got reelected last year with something on the odds of 60% on the vote. Is very, you know, quite popular and effective. But, you know, the thing in in Pennsylvania is that the right wing lawmakers there, they were the same who are literally about to overturn the election if the Supreme Court hadn't stopped them. Or the state Supreme Court, I believe it was. The study in question, which is peer-reviewed and published in August by the Journal of Criminology and Public Policy, claimed that Krasner's policy of deprosecution was associated with a statistically significant increase in murders in Philadelphia compared to the rates recorded under his predecessors. The study by Thomas Hogan, an adjunct fellow for the Manhattan Institute, who served two terms as a tough-on-crime prosecutor in Chester County, Pennsylvania, engendered harsh criticism among social scientists who said the quantitative method of his study was undermined by its flaws. People who are serious about solving and preventing crime should look at serious and accurate research, not political documents like Hogan's, said Jessica Brand, a spokesperson for the Krasner Office, who leads the Wren Collective, a firm that advises reform-minded prosecutors. People's lives, after all, are at stake. So a Pennsylvania House vote on whether the impeach Krasner is going to take place this week. Hogan's study formed the entire basis of what the committee outlined as one of the four negative effects of Krasner's policies in Philadelphia. D.A. Krasner's philosophies and those of other progressive prosecutors across the country have been widely criticized, the committee's report said. For example, Thomas Hogan, a former prosecutor at the state and federal level, again, by the way, an elected partisan Republican, cannot make that any more clear. Conducted a study entitled Deprosecution and Death, a synthetic control analysis of the impact of deprosecution on homicides, in which he significantly focused on the deprosecution of crime in Philadelphia pursuant to the adoption of progressive policies between 2015 and 2019. The report went on to quote extensively from Hogan in a page-long summary of his study. The study had come under attack pretty much as soon as it was released. The broad-scale deprosecution of the policy, prosecution policy of Philadelphia, particularly for firearm and drug trafficking offenses, appears to have a casual association with large increases in homicides. Oh, it's casual, all right. Believe me. Hogan wrote in his study, the public in Philadelphia will have to make a normative choice between a reduction in the number of prosecutions and an increase in homicides. Hogan also suggested that the city of Philadelphia should consider whether to decrease the budget of the DA's office in response to a decrease in prosecutions. Scholars in the field of criminology, sociology, and economic policy were quick to criticize the study and claimed that it had methodological issues and factual errors, including Hogan's decision to count individual homicides rather than per capita homicide rates. Oh, dear God. So, yeah, the crime rate for Philadelphia, it really surged because, you know, in comparison to the rest of the local area, you know, it's really crazy stuff. You know, just not counting by per capita is probably like one of the most basic mistakes you can make, or, you know, there weren't mistakes in this case, obviously, they're, you know, politically motivated decisions. In September, a group of scholars submitted an article to the same journal outlining what they described as fatal flaws in Hogan's study, warning against it. Use in to inform criminal justice policy. The authors also requested that Hogan share the data he used to produce his study, which he did not reply. The journal rejected the paper. Surprise, surprise. You know, any journal that is going to publish him in the first place, Hogan is probably not going to be, you know, a very fair minded adjudicator there. So the authors also, in a response published to a Substack, Hogan said the critique itself was based on flawed methodology. What a surprise. The flaws in the paper were apparently apparent pretty quickly to anyone with access to data and familiarity with causal inference methods. Jennifer Doliak, a professor of economics at Texas A&M University, wrote in a Twitter thread to criticize Hogan's paper. She also criticized the journal's decision to reject the critique. They discussed the main issues with the analysis, especially flawed data cleaning and cherry-picking results. Clearly and thoroughly, they show that correcting these issues produces a null effect on homicide. So, surprise, surprise. But really, you know, this is going to be what it always is in situations like this. It's a contest of political power between someone like Larry Krasner, who has done a really pretty good job for the people of Philadelphia in terms of just giving them an alternative in terms of crime. I think it's going to be a very, very important story to watch, is will this really anti-democratic effort to take down this guy succeed? We will keep you posted on that. We're back in 2 days. It's Newsflash.